It's my pleasure and privilege to be with you all tonight, and I appreciate very much the opportunity to participate in the study, and I'm thankful for the topic that was given to me and the opportunity I had to study this remarkable man's life and his influence on those who followed Jesus. A student who struggled to appreciate history was charged by his teacher to read a biography of Thomas Jefferson. And after becoming acquainted with the life and legacy of that founding father, the student tearfully reported to his instructor, "How can it be that my life was so touched by a man I never knew?" But that's the nature of history. I don't necessarily expect any of you to tearfully report to me how impressed you were by the life of Daniel Sommer, but I hope at least that through what I say this evening, you'll realize that Daniel Sommer was a man of incredible influence, and he influenced us, even if we don't realize it. He was born 10 years before Abraham Lincoln was elected president and died the year Franklin Delano Roosevelt finished his second term in the White House. His experience in the Restoration Movement spans from the time of Alexander Campbell to that of Homer King. He was baptized 3 years after Alexander Campbell died in 1869, but in this room are men and women who lived contemporaneous to him. None of us knew him personally, as far as I know, but he's touched our lives. And for a short while this evening, I want us to consider his life and influence, especially on the Restoration Movement and the Churches of Christ in America, and particularly our Brotherhood. Daniel Sommer was born January 11, 1850, in St. Mary's County, Maryland, to John and Magdalena Sommer, a Hessian and a Bavarian. Mr. and Mrs. Sommer migrated to America in 1835, and they were married here in the U.S. near Washington, D.C. in 1840. They were nominal Lutherans who did not attend church services but had all of their children sprinkled by a Lutheran pastor. John was a foul-mouthed blacksmith and a heavy drinker who worked hard but saved little money. He died of pneumonia when Daniel was a very young boy and left his widow and several children penniless. So from a young age, Daniel Sommer learned independence and resiliency and the value of hard work. He was a very tall, very strong, and very strong-willed person from all reports of those who knew him. He was reared with the pioneer mindset of personal responsibility and pride in his accomplishments, and such was his nature for the rest of his life. He was a poor student, and in reports that I've read, when he was a young boy in school and he would be taking an exam, he would shake his head violently back and forth, trying to shake the facts out so he could remember what it was that he'd read before. And apparently he continued to do that for years ahead. But he was a diligent laborer. In his autobiography, he tells of only one teacher who ever motivated him to enjoy academic learning, a Scotsman named Hector Home Monroe. And he was so impressed with Mr. Monroe that later he used him as the title character of his fictional work, describing an honest man's journey to New Testament Christianity, which he called Hector among the doctors. In 1863, a young Daniel attended a Sunday school in his community where he was introduced to religion. He took religion seriously and applied to it the same dedication to that he otherwise applied to physical labor. Young Sommer was, through these influences, led to piety and strict moral uprightness. From all accounts, even those who criticized him, he was a decent person in the way that he carried himself in this life. And thus it's not surprising that at first he gravitated toward the Methodists, who in that day were known for their seriousness and dedication to separated and holy living. In 1864, Sommer had grown somewhat lax in his religion, and he attended a Methodist revival. Believing that he'd already gotten religion, he came forward to join the church. But in 1866, Daniel Sommer was introduced to a different kind of religion than he'd ever known. He witnessed a baptism conducted by D.S. Burnett, and soon after began to work for a man in Hartford County, Maryland, who was a Christian following only the New Testament. The man, John Dallas Everett, studied with Daniel until he became convinced of the error of infant sprinkling, and Sommer was immersed by T.A. Crenshaw in 1869. Having learned the truth, Sommer's heart was full of burning passion to preach it to others. And realizing the need for some education, he enrolled at the most prestigious school in the Brotherhood at that time, which also happened to be right in his neighborhood, Bethany College in West Virginia. Alexander Campbell had died only 3 years before Sommer came to Bethany, and as one said, his spirit still loomed large at the campus. Robert Richardson, well, there's Bethany, actually, for those who are interested. Robert Richardson, in this picture, although an old man, was still at the school, and respected educators like C.L. Lewes were on the faculty. W.K. Pendleton, famous for his completion of the fourfold gospel, which he did jointly with J.W. McGarvey, served as president during Sommer's time at Bethany. To this point, Sommer had never risen above the abject poverty of his youth, and simplicity of living and personal responsibility and hard work were still very much a part of how he viewed the world. Sommer would have fit in well, I think, with the old restorers like Barton W. Stone, who prized piety and sacrifice for religious service. However, the heirs of the Restoration Movement, what historians would call the second generation restorers, were very different from their forefathers. Many of the faculty and students at Bethany, and there's another shot of it, were worldly in the truest sense of the term. Speculative theories about religion and a desire to be like the denominations, two of the things most despised by the previous reformers, were commonplace. Earl West describes a very unusual division among the students and faculty at Bethany during the early period of Sommer's enrollment. Some believe that the Bible was a revelation only to sinners, that it told how to be converted, but offered no practical instruction for Christian living. Beyond baptism, the rule was, love God and do as you please. There were no laws governing the church, and in the final analysis, sincerity was sufficient for fellowship with the Lord. President Pendleton was a proponent of this view, which actually surprised me a great deal to learn. But Sommer had no interest in it. In fact, he became an aggressive opponent of it, even as a new student. It's almost certain that this apostasy from the old Restoration principles contributed to the formation of Sommer's later views on Bible colleges, which we'll discuss in a moment. However, there was one event that indisputably signaled the beginning of Sommer's career fighting the issue that would occupy his attention for the greater part of his life, an issue we've talked about today, institutionalism. During Sommer's time at Bethany, some ladies from the Brush Run congregation, or the Bethany Church of Christ, decided to raise money to buy new curtains and a carpet and to paint the meeting house. And they formed what was called a mite society. The name referred to a special collection that was taken up from members of the church to fund the society's business, decorating and remodeling the building. Most of the members of the congregation approved of the idea and were fully on board, including C.L. Lewes, who was an elder. But Daniel Sommer didn't like it. He saw the Mite Society as an example of worldliness and carnality and a distraction from the spiritual mission of the church and the Christian life. It was common for the congregation to call students in to preach a Sunday sermon, and Daniel accepted the invitation, taking the opportunity to condemn the Mite Society from the pulpit. His sermon was so scathing and powerful that within a few weeks the society had disbanded. Sommer said that from that day forward he operated on the principle that all departures from the apostolic order of things should be swiftly and soundly denounced. Most people in the Brotherhood did not take kindly to Sommer's self-appointed role as Brotherhood watchdog, as he was called by many of his critics. But Earl West said something I think is worthy of repeating. He graciously noted that it's better to have a watchdog that barks too much than one that barks not at all. I think that's something worth thinking about when we are annoyed by people raising alarms, that sometimes alarms need to be raised and we need to be introspective of what's going on among us and in our own lives and in our own faith. I think this will prove true as we further investigate Sommer's life. Most biographers and historians take a low view of Daniel Sommer, lambasting him as a divisive and discordant person. And as we'll see, some of that assessment is correct. But it's also true that Daniel Sommer played a vital role and occupied an important place in the history of the Lord's church in America. Had he not done and written and preached what he did, the Restoration Movement would have radically changed from its original shape, and with it, the churches of Christ in this nation. We'll explore that further in a moment, but now back to Sommer's life. When Sommer began his career as a preacher of the gospel, his early exploits and service were unremarkable and hardly worthy of mention. In fact, it's very difficult to find any written material about them. But there was a significant upheaval in the Brotherhood, typified by what Sommer had encountered at Bethany College. The Christians in America, as Kevin mentioned this afternoon, were dividing over two practical issues, the missionary society and the use of instrumental music in the worship. But really, these issues were symptomatic of a larger division that had more to do with an ideology toward religion. The original restorers saw a two-sided need in Christendom. Christians needed unity, and they needed a restoration of apostolic Christianity. And men like Alexander Campbell and Thomas Campbell and Barton W. Stone and Walter Scott and Moses Lard, those two themes were codependent. Unity could not be accomplished without restoration, and restoration would inevitably lead to unity. Most of those men were post-millennialists, and they believed that the restoration movement would last for a little while. They'd work hard, and then they would see the good fruit of it. Denominationalism would vanish, and all error and digression and apostasy would be done away with. But, of course, that didn't happen. And as the restoration movement continued, and it was successful but not as successful as some of the prophets had forecasted, a disagreement began to arise. It manifested itself in those issues of societies and instrumental music, and when it became hot and severe, it was manifest among the second generation restorers that one idea or the other was more favored. One group, under the leadership of Isaac Arendt, saw unity as the paramount goal. Restoration was a nice idea, but if it interfered with unity, then it wasn't really that necessary. But another group, under the leadership of Ben Franklin in the North and David Lipscomb and Talbert Fanning in the South, saw restoration as the primary goal. And if unity could be accomplished, that's wonderful. But most important was getting back to the ancient and primitive faith of the first Christians and of the apostles particularly. It was inevitable that the holders of these two perspectives would grow apart and in different directions, regardless of what issues it was that might have driven the split. Daniel Sommer was naturally bent to lean more toward the conservative side, although we'll notice some of his positions, and we wouldn't call them conservative at all. But in 1871, Sommer attended a gospel meeting in Wellsburg, West Virginia, held by Benjamin Franklin, and he was the editor of the American Christian Review, at that point the most influential journal in the United States, at least among believers in the Bible. You know, I think that we don't really appreciate how important, maybe we some do, but most people probably don't appreciate how important religious journals were in the history of the churches of Christ here in America. The American Christian Review had a subscribership that spanned the nation. And what appeared in the pages of that paper had a tremendous impact on what people believed and decisions people made. Daniel Sommer instantly admired the aged Ben Franklin, and for the rest of his days would consider him to be the greatest preacher to live since apostolic times. Franklin returned the affection to Sommer and especially appreciated Daniel's passion and fire for the Bible. During that meeting, Franklin lamented to Sommer how that the Central Christian Church in Cincinnati, where Franklin lived, was building a $140,000 meeting house. Think about that. In 1871, it was a $140,000 meeting house with an $8,000 organ. At that point, it was the most extravagant display in the history of the Restoration Movement. And it grieved Franklin's heart. He saw it as the ultimate example of how the church was going worldly. It was interested only in social acceptance. Wasn't satisfied with pleasing God, but not pleasing men around. This meeting impacted Daniel Sommer's life, perhaps more than any other event. And from that day forward, he was the protege and heir apparent of Ben Franklin. He dropped out of Bethany College, never returned to take his final exam. And for the rest of his life, Sommer had an antipathy toward scholasticism. While he was well-studied and well-read, as shown in his preaching and writing, he didn't care for extra-biblical religious material, although somewhat paradoxically, he wrote a whole bunch of it. And we're going to find out that a great deal of Daniel Sommer's life was very paradoxical. In his sermon book, Plain Sermons, which is for sale in the back, I'll make a plug for that, it is entirely dedicated to the simplicity and sufficiency of the Bible. His belief that the Bible was an all-sufficient book, a belief that was common among the early restorers but was slipping out of vogue in the late 19th century, was the foundation for his other beliefs that only Bible-authorized worship and Bible institutions were sufficient to accomplish their intended task and acceptable in the Christian faith. His view of Christianity was evident from the name of the paper he published, The Octograph. Now, that's kind of an odd name to us, and it was not very popular. People subscribed to the paper, but most of them were farmers, and according to reports, they would go into town, they'd say, well, have you read The Octopus this month, or The Orthograph? And nobody really knew what the paper was called, but Octograph means the writing of eight, and it refers to the eight authors of the New Testament. That was his premise. Sommer passionately argued that true religion could only be the religion of faith in Christ Jesus. And as the old restorers believed, Christian faith comes only from the testimony of apostolic writings. In 1879, there was a noteworthy event. Just slip it in here. Sommer was bitten by a dog. He thought the dog was rabid. And he believed he was rabid afterward, and he took a bizarre poultice from a Quaker who lived next door, and he wrote about that experience in a book called Hydrophobia and Its Cures. And it's worth reading because at the end he talks about spiritual hydrophobia, the denominational world's fear of baptism. And it's a pretty good book. He was a good writer. After Ben Franklin's death in the fall of 1879, a battle began which lasted several years and involved a great deal of less than Christian behavior over who would succeed him as editor of the American Christian Review. The first successor was John F. Rao. He was assisted by G.W. Rice. However, Rao was unsuccessful for the paper, and for a time it was owned and operated by non-church members. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine if some non-believers published the Old Paths Advocate or the Christian Expositor, one of the papers in our brotherhood today? The Christian Leader was a paper started by Rao as he became dissatisfied with the Review. And so Daniel Sommer purchased the American Christian Review for the modern-day equivalent of $250,000. And he combined it with his paper, The Octograph, and called it The Octographic Review, which was still a weird name, hard to say, and very unpopular with a lot of people. Later, he changed the name to the Apostolic Review. Through his paper, Sommer would wield his greatest influence on Christians in this nation. In 1894, he moved to Indianapolis, Indiana, to publish the paper there and lived in that city until his death. Sommer became a leading force through the northern states, especially Indiana and Illinois. One of the most important events of his life was in 1889 in Shelby County, Illinois, at a large brotherhood gathering at the Sand Creek Meeting House. 6,000 Christians gathered at Sand Creek. I don't think they all fit in the building, but they were there for an old-time equivalent of the get-together meetings we still enjoy today. And Sommer delivered a famous speech called the Address and Declaration. The name was a play on Thomas Campbell's Declaration and Address, said to have started the Restoration Movement 80 years earlier. And the Address and Declaration restated the desire to reproduce the Apostolic Church and accomplish Christian unity in the same. This speech, however, directly addressed certain areas in which members of the Lord's Church had departed or were departing from the historic plea for the Bible only, and were teaching and practicing things that could not be found in or taught in New Testament Scripture. Specifically named were collecting money for the church through festivals, choral rather than congregational singing, missionary societies, and the one-man pastor system, although it was stated that these were a part of a larger family of digressions from the New Testament model. The Declaration stated, and this was probably its most significant message, that those congregations whose leaders signed the document were formally declaring their intention to separate fellowship from those who persistently and in the face of much appeal and rebuke continued in those unscriptural practices. Now, I've heard speakers say that Daniel Sommer in the Sand Creek Address changed the Restoration Movement from a unity movement to a division movement. But I believe that's unfair. I think it's a misrepresentation of history. As was previously pointed out, Sommer was only a part of a larger group of people who for some time had been looking at Christianity differently from others. Isaac Arad and J.H. Garrison and those who had become known as the disciples of Christ, they didn't look at the Bible at all in the same way as Daniel Sommer and those of his brethren. In fact, some historians like Earl West view the Sand Creek meeting as insignificant. Although he writes extensively about the life and experiences of Daniel Sommer, West never even mentions the events at Sand Creek. Another noteworthy aspect of Sommer's life and legacy was his opposition to Bible colleges. After Bethany was overtaken by liberalism, conservatives, especially Southerners like Talbert Fanning and David Lipscomb and James Harding, began establishing and promoting a number of Bible schools. In 1891, the Nashville Bible School opened. By 1901, Daniel Sommer was vigorously attacking the school through the pages of the Review. Although Sommer's opposition to Bible colleges began much earlier, he published in 1878 a series of articles on educating preachers that dealt with the issue. In 1907, Sommer debated B.F. Rhodes on the Bible college issue in Odessa and Hale, Missouri. Sommer's position on Bible colleges was negative, no question about that. But beyond that, it was somewhat enigmatic. In his debate with Rhodes, he stated that he was opposed to colleges in the business of making money and producing doctors and graduates for the glory of men. But he favored ventures like Alexander Campbell's Buffalo Seminary. That's kind of interesting to me. In 1905, Sommer published in bold print his position on colleges on the front page of the Review, and it shocked James Harding to read that Sommer did not oppose individual Christians establishing schools to teach the Bible. He simply opposed the church establishing a college or donating money to it or any other society to do its work for it. Harding contended that he and Sommer virtually agreed and wondered why they had so long wrangled. However, Sommer's descendants like Carl Ketcherside seem to have taken a much stricter view on the issue. And I believe Brother Nathan Batty republished Ketcheside's treatise on colleges, and he argues in there that any institution designed to teach the Bible was a human replacement for the all-sufficient church. Perhaps Sommer himself believed that at some point, but he claimed that he never did. Daniel Sommer died February the 19th in 1940. He was 90 years old. He lived through the Civil and both World Wars. Saw the Industrial Revolution in its entirety. Amazing to think about a man in that day in history living to such an old age. It's a testimony to his strength. And this is an abridged biography of Daniel Sommer. And in our time remaining, I want to discuss briefly some of the negative and positive influence I believe he had on the churches of Christ, especially our brotherhood. What history calls Sommerism, a term that he no doubt would oppose because it's sectarian, cannot simply be defined as the beliefs of Daniel Sommer, because as we've seen, his beliefs were quite fluid and labeled by one of his biographers as schizophrenic. Sommer himself, while speaking at Fried Hardeman University, famously said, "I'm not the man I used to be. In fact, I never was." Now, you can see it's kind of difficult to analyze a person like that. Sommerism must be understood then through the views of those uniquely influenced by Sommer in the height of his editorship in the Apostolic Review. As the liberals and conservatives in the second and third generation restoration movement drifted apart because of ideological differences, so the churches of Christ in the North, primarily influenced by Sommer and the Review, grew in a different direction from churches in the South, primarily influenced by Lipscomb and Harding and the Gospel Advocate. The Apostolic Review faltered and eventually died under the feuding of Sommer's family. In order to maintain his clergy certificate with the rail system and to get a discount, Sommer gave the editorship of the paper to his wife, Mrs. K.W. Sommer. Now, you can't read this, but underneath the picture of that surly-looking woman is Mrs. K.W. Sommer, beloved former editor and publisher of our paper. As Carl Ketcheside observed, she did not take the position lightly. And when her husband became involved in church trouble in the West, she cut him out of the paper and refused to print his articles. His son, Daniel Austin, was left off of the editorial staff. He and his father feuded bitterly. And so he started his own paper, the Macedonian Call. At one point, D.A., as he was called, withdrew fellowship from his father and refused to even allow him into his home. And Daniel responded by saying, "My son is a chip cut from the butt of humanity." I don't know what he meant by that or how crude he intended to be, but it sounds pretty rough to me. When Mrs. Sommer died and the paper passed on to two of her other children, the rest of the Sommerite brotherhood turned against the family, including Daniel. Carl Ketcheside, Sommer's heir apparent, challenged Daniel to a debate when Daniel was 85 years old. Fortunately, Ketcheside later said the debate never happened. But what was the Sommerite Brotherhood? Now, this term historically refers to churches of Christ in America that opposed Bible colleges and opposed the paid located minister, or as they called it, the pastor system. In place of colleges, the Sommerite churches held Bible, well, there's Daniel Sommer, there we go, held Bible readings. This is a photograph of the first Bible reading ever held. You can see how big Daniel Sommer was. He's there sitting in the middle on the front row, and he's towering above all the other people. And these Bible readings were lengthy seminars in which attendants were taught how to study the Bible effectively as well, how to give public speeches, sometimes how to sing and how to lead songs. They were between 6 weeks. Some of them were 18 months. I read about one that was 24 months long. As you see, Sommer was quite progressive. I believe this was held in the 1880s, maybe the 1870s, and you see an African-American attending, which was almost unheard of in events like this in those days. But Daniel Sommer was not afraid of any criticism that he might receive. That's just worthy of note. In place of located pulpit ministers, the Sommerite churches practiced what they called mutual edification. In fact, the more favorable way of referring to these churches is mutual edification churches, where everybody shared in the teaching. Interestingly, some are turned against both of these positions not long after espousing them. And he decried the Bible readings, and he said of mutual edification that most of the time it was more mutual than edifying. Several prominent preachers and writers were associated with these churches in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, including A.M. Morris, E.M. Zur, D.A. Sommer, W.G. Roberts, Robert Brumback, Carl Ketcheside, Alfred Elmore, and others. Most of these men held similar views to Daniel, such as his approval of Christian involvement in carnal warfare, his endorsement of the Bible class system, and his acceptance of sectarian baptism. Although many of these refused to acknowledge any connection with Sommer himself, Robert Brumback, in his church history book, doesn't even mention Daniel Sommer's name. He wouldn't even know that he existed, although he writes a great deal about the Sand Creek Address. Among those who early associated with the Sommerites were several men who would go on to be leaders in the battle against individual cups and Bible classes. And this is what I really want to show you. The Daniel Sommer and his influence had a direct relation to our brotherhood. This photograph, oh, I've got a little laser here. It shows some interesting people. This bearded gentleman is Alfred Elmore. I believe he's kin somehow to Johnny. Over here is A.M. Morris, who wrote The Prophecies Unveiled. Up here is Fred Sommer, who shared in editing the Apostolic Review. Down here is a man named C.T. Cook, not Clovis Tannehill Cook, but I wondered if they were related. C.T. Cook was one of the leading voices in favor of one cup in the Lord's Supper and in opposition to Bible classes in the state of Indiana. And then this man is W.J. Rice. W.J. Rice was at this time living in the city here of Covington, Indiana, where this Bible reading was held, and he was publishing a paper called The Gospel Echo with Brother Elmore. From here, he would move to Clio, Oklahoma, and then to Corpus Christi, Texas. And he would there begin to publish a new paper called The Apostolic Way, which led to Brother Harper's paper, The Truth, which led ultimately to the Old Paths Advocate. Sommer's influence is seen in the masthead of The Apostolic Way. Sommer emphasized the sufficiency of divinely appointed institutions to do their appointed work, and the early opponents of Bible classes raised this objection: the church Bible class takes responsibility of teaching children out of the home where God put it. It's noteworthy that the preachers and churches advocating one cup in the Lord's Supper and opposing Bible classes were later influenced by Austin McGary and the Firm Foundation here in the state of Texas. And consequently, they separated from Sommer and his people over the rebaptism issue. In fact, Brother Harper had a sort of a debate with Daniel Sommer on rebaptism. In many ways, there, in spite of these differences, there is a definite historical connection to Daniel Sommer and the Review, in many ways stronger than our connection to David Lipscomb and the Gospel Advocate. This was seen in the 1950s when our brethren were decidedly against located preachers of any kind, and many men here could say more about that than I can. Sommer's personal influence over the attitudes and approaches of the churches of Christ was both negative and positive. In the negative, he influenced conservative churches to avoid cities and metropolitan areas. Early in his career, he associated cities with worldliness and digression. City people were too proud and materialistic to accept simple New Testament Christianity. He reasoned with W.B.F. Treat that the church shouldn't even try to evangelize cities. In a conversation with Brother Treat, he said, "No use building churches in the cities. The towns and cities are bound to go to the devil anyway." Other than Sommer's final placement in Indianapolis, the Northern conservatives focused on defending rural churches from liberal inroads. And I see this as an example of how well-meaning people can sometimes equate their wisdom with divine truth. And the consequences for conservative Christianity have been negative. Most of our domestic mission work is historically done at country crossroads in the middle of the woods, and it resulted in country churches with no community to fill them. And eventually, the people who lived in that area moved away, and the church building now stands empty. I think Sommer's thinking may have influenced this practice, but the New Testament model seems to be different. Ancient Christians were not afraid of working in evil cities like Corinth and expanding out from there. So our historic method has actually produced more empty meeting houses in the middle of nowhere than anything else. A second, Sommer's conduct as an editor turned the religious journals into instruments of sectarianism. Sommer equated loyalty to his paper with loyalty to the truth, and as such, he refused that anything should be discussed in his paper that he disagreed with, unwilling to publish any dissenting views. This was a departure from the historic role of religious journals as a forum for discussion to overcome disagreements, a process vital to the restoration of New Testament Christianity. Sommer's conduct contributed to the church's fracturing over what journal their members read, and eventually led to the ultimate decline of religious journals in American Christianity. Most could and perhaps, more could and perhaps should be said on that, but I won't. Third, Sommer practiced inconsistent conservatism. What Sommer opposed in Bible colleges, at least to some degree and for some reason, at the very least, he opposed them because he believed they generated pride and worldliness. His Bible readings were not much different. Sommer's Bible readings charged tuition. He found that they produced unqualified and ignorant people, made them think that they were preachers. And so finally he gave them up, although they continued to be used by the Sommerite churches. I've got more information on that if anyone has a question. He opposed the institutional Sunday school, but he supported Bible classes, which were substantially no different at all. In his debate with J.N. Cowan, we see in action the old proverb, "The legs of the lame are unequal." If you ever have the chance to read that debate, you'll understand what I mean. He drew firm lines of fellowship over instrumental music and choirs and improper methods of collecting church funds because, as he said, it is safe and only safe to teach and practice what the divine record enjoins on the disciples. But he scoffed at those who rejected individual cups in the Lord's Supper and Bible classes on the same grounds. In his final years, he toppled from this logical balancing act and embraced a position much closer to the liberalism that he previously opposed. It's noteworthy that the same thing happened to his successor, W. Carl Ketcherside. From my perspective, Sommer's most positive influence on the churches of Christ was his fight to keep the restoration plea alive when several influential voices were calling for its revision, if not its utter abandonment. Fanning, Lipscomb, and Harding led a group of persons and congregations to become what we today would call the mainline churches of Christ. Daniel Sommer, in spite of the major differences between us and him on a number of issues, preserved a way of thinking about New Testament Christianity that allowed some brethren to survive a firestorm of innovations and digressions that hit the church during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So in conclusion, if Daniel Sommer was alive today, he would not fellowship us, and we would not fellowship him. He would call us radical and we'd call him liberal. His literature may not be the most helpful and most agreeable to us across the board. It's, I think, worthy of reading most of the time. But he was an important historical figure whose influence cannot be denied and should not be ignored. Usually, examinations of Sommer's life focus more on his attitude than his positions. But I've tried to give more attention to his views and further developments in Christian thinking that they inspired. God will judge Mr. Sommer for eternity. But ask this question. If you and I were in the same place, if we saw that radical changes were sweeping through the Lord's church, threatening to destroy the spirit of primitive Christianity, would we have the courage to speak out, the resolve to stand up against what was wrong, regardless of how history stigmatized us in years to come? That's my presentation.